Hello, and welcome to D&D Book Club. My name is Megan, and today we'll be doing something different. I recently had the opportunity to get together with Sharday and Lissa, the two hosts of the Slovenly Trolls podcast, which you can find on Spotify, Apple, Google, or anywhere else podcasts can be found. The Slovenly Trolls is a series which examines early Dungeons & Dragons through a modern feminist lens. Unlike the typical examples of critical theory we see manifested in the form of Twitter outrage culture, however, the Slovenly Trolls take a rigorous approach to their analysis of D&D, using hard statistics and rational arguments to support their hypotheses. If you're a female player who wants to understand the game from a female-centric perspective, or you're a male player who perhaps wants to help foster a more inclusive community for women, Slovenly Trolls is a podcast you absolutely must listen to. But you might be asking yourself, is this really necessary? We all know women play D&D. Some of the best players on the most popular streaming shows are women. And much of what made the early game unappealing to women has been purged from the modern game. Why look back at all? Well, to answer that, let me transport you back in time to the 1980s and 1990s. These were the decades of first and second edition, when the average Dungeons & Dragons player would be called a nerd at best and a Satanist at worst. This was also a time when female players were rare and Dungeons & Dragons was very much a boys' club. Younger players used the game to escape to a world where they could be the dashing hero rescuing the damsel in distress. Older players maybe just wanted an evening hanging out with the guys. But negative stereotypes developed of socially awkward dweebs and obnoxious neckbeards lurking in basements the world over. In this context, how could players not feel a need to withdraw into their gaming world? Unfortunately, the result was an insular, male-driven community that did not make women feel welcome or wanted, intentionally or unintentionally. Now it's 2021, and it's much easier to be a female D&D player and to be welcomed at most tables and treated with respect. But in order to continue fostering a community that is as welcoming to women as it is to men, it's important to understand how that community developed, how that development is reflected in the game and related media, how both have thankfully improved over the years, and how they can continue to improve. Ultimately, it's all about making the game and the community better by allowing new perspectives and ideas to blossom, while still holding on to what made the early days of D&D so special for so many of us. In that spirit, I invited the Slovenly Trolls to discuss the early Dragonlance novels, specifically the Chronicles Trilogy and Legends Trilogy by Margaret Weis and Tracy Hickman, to explore what still holds up, what hasn't quite aged so well, and how reading the novels with a critical eye can actually create layers of depth to characters and stories you might not have otherwise appreciated. This episode is not, I repeat, not a condemnation of Dragonlance or its authors in any way. I love these novels, and I will always love these novels. But loving a novel doesn't mean you just have to ignore its flaws, especially after 40 years. These novels endure because every generation can find their own enjoyment and their own meaning, and that's true even for those of us who became hooked on Dragonlance as children. If this doesn't sound like something you want to listen to, feel free to skip this episode, and I hope you'll join me once again in a few weeks for my exploration of the Ravenloft classic Spectre of the Black Rose by James Lowder and Veronica Whitney Robinson. If you have any questions, feel free to email me at dndbookclub@gmail.com. That's D-A-N-D-D Book Club. Or follow me on Instagram at dndbookclub. If you wish to support the show with a subscription of only $5 per month, please consider becoming a patron by visiting patreon.com/dndbookclub. Oh, and one more thing. I apologize in advance for the audio issues. It was my first time doing a remote interview, and there were a few kinks. If you notice a weird echo, don't worry, it goes away after the first half. Now, let's begin with part one of our two-part discussion by welcoming Sharday and Lissa, the Slovenly Trolls. Hello, welcome, Sharday and Lissa from the Slovenly Trolls.
Hello. Hello. Thank you for having us.
I'm very...
Yes, thank you for having us here.
I'm very excited to have you guys. This is the first collaboration I've ever done. I've had kind of aborted attempts to do them, but this is the first time it's ever actually worked out.
Yeah, same. First collab. Yay! Collab virginity is broken.
So I'm just going to start with some kind of basic introductory questions just to get introduce you to my audience.
Yeah.
So how did you both get into Dungeons and Dragons? Sharday, you go first.
Okay. Well, I started playing when I was in middle school. So I was about 12. We played for around a year. But then we transitioned our game from tabletop, and this is 3.5 edition. So this was maybe about 2006, 2007. And then we transitioned into LARPing, and I did that more through high school, like used a homebrew LARPing system. We just took our characters from D&D and just placed them somewhere else. And then right before I started my master's degree, so this was in 2016, I rediscovered Dungeons & Dragons by stumbling upon Critical Role. And I'm just like, oh, yeah, I used to play Dungeons and Dragons. Maybe I'll, you know, listen to this and, like, see what has changed in, like, the 10 years it's been. And then I fell in love with it because it's very performative, what Critical Role does. And I'm just like, oh, my God, this is just like LARPing, except I don't have to move. I can just sit at a table. I don't have to be active. That's amazing.
I feel like you hear a lot of stories about people getting into D&D through Critical Role.
You do. Yeah, it's great. After that, I got into DMing, and now here I am with a lot of opinions on D&D.
Now you're a world-famous Dungeons & Dragons podcaster.
Oh my gosh, yeah. Everybody knows who we are throughout the world, especially.
Are you sure about that?
What about you, Lisa? How did you get started?
2 years ago, I met someone, a mutual friend of ours, who's in Sharday's campaign. You know, we were friends. And she said, do you like fantasy stuff? Would you like to do like a really RP heavy game? I think she said. And so I sat in on one of Sharday's sessions and I didn't really understand what was going on. You know, they were drinking a little bit of alcohol there, and they were having a lot of fun, is what I remember.
I feel exposed, first off.
Yeah, so all I remember was sitting at the table and realizing that, like, I have no idea what's going on. They were talking a lot, and it just didn't make any sense, because, you know, in the middle of a campaign and everything. And I didn't know who the characters were, but everybody was laughing and having fun. And I was like, okay, you know, this seems like something I could do. And then I joined not one, but two campaigns. And here we are.
Yeah, funny how that happens. You start with one and then somehow you end up in multiple. Tell me, I've never actually asked you guys this. I keep meaning to ask you, but what are you actually playing right now? Are you two in the same group together? And what are you playing?
Oh, yeah. So for DMing, I play, you know, all the NPCs, whatever. But yeah, we're in a mutual friends campaign, and I'm playing a bard with two levels in cleric. She was a revenant, so she was a zombie, but now she has been restored back to her human form. So I am playing a human bard who has got impregnated twice, because obviously bards. But she's married. It's by her husband, okay? Like, she's not sleeping around getting pregnant by everybody. She's married.
Hang on, we'll get to that later in the episode. But what setting are you playing in?
My campaign is set in Tal'Dorei, which is Matt Mercer's world, because I watched so much Critical Role first before, and I'm just now getting into old D&D lore and like wanting to do Faerun and wanting to do like even just something in Baldur's Gate because it's so iconic. But I knew the world of Critical Role better when I started DMing. So I have the Tal'Dorei campaign guide and my campaign is set there. But the game Liss and I are in is a homebrew world.
That's interesting. I feel like, I don't think I've ever really talked to somebody who is playing in a Critical Role. What is it called? Tal'Dorei?
Tal'Dorei, yeah.
Tal'Dorei. I don't think I've ever talked to somebody who's actually like running a game there. I feel like everybody does Eberron or Faerun. it seems like that's where everybody's playing unless they're doing a homebrew.
Yeah, I think it's just because it's so new. Critical Role, the new campaign is set in a place called, where is it? Westron? No, that's a city. It's another continent. Their second campaign is set on another Wildmount. It starts with a W. That's what it was. Wildmount. They have a book now with Wizards of the Coast where Wildmount, which is in the same world that Tal'Dorei is in, is now part of the D&D multiverse, which is insane.
So, Lissa, what are you playing right now?
So I'm in two campaigns as a player. In Shardaze 1, I play a wuss of a half-orc. She is a barbarian because I'm, you know, very original half-orc barbarian. But, yeah, she has anxiety, so she's not, like, regular. And then in the other campaign that Sharday and I are both in, I play a sassy tiefling monk because that was the first character I ever made and I had no idea what I was doing.
So the next thing I wanted to do, so you have a podcast of your own, the Slovenly Trolls, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. I would say the theme of your podcast is sort of feminism and how it relates to Dungeons & Dragons the game and Dungeons & Dragons the community. Do you have a certain way that you think about it?
I think the way that I explain it to friends, it's taking a look at Dungeons & Dragons history and viewing it from a feminist perspective, but also kind of giving it the benefit of the doubt. To be honest, there's a bit of sexism because obviously the game was kind of geared more towards men and a certain kind of person. So we take a look at some of the more problematic issues of, you know, the origins of D&D, but we give it the benefit of the doubt, we give it context, and then we talk about and review how it's changed since then.
I really like that you say the benefit of the doubt, because that's something that I feel is a sense of giving them the benefit of the doubt is important, and that it kind of goes over the heads sometimes of the people who might disagree with the notion mm-hmm. of examining Dungeons and Dragons through a feminist, mm-hmm. you know, in a feminist context. They might just say, oh, well, why do you need to do this? It's fine. Or there's that.
I think
because you're being critical that you're also like, because you're criticizing something that you view it in a negative way, which is not necessarily.
Yeah, exactly. And like we both come, like we started this podcast both after graduating, Lissa with her bachelor's and me with my master's. So we kind of like came at it from a very research oriented perspective after writing a bunch of analyses and papers. And we know that you have to contextualize things and you have to ask yourself this question, but why are things the way that they are? And usually the answer is because society made them that way, or like because there is something going on at the time, either politically or socially. And so we try to bring that context into it, definitely not to give like an excuse for these things that have happened, because most of the time there really isn't an excuse, but we understand that we're coming from a new millennium perspective on things that were created in like the 1970s onward.
Yeah.
Like, you know, grounding ourselves in that kind of context, maybe explaining to people why these things might have happened, not excusing them, but at least giving a bigger picture, because, you know, we're all on Twitter or just like on the internet, and like outrage culture is huge. And like we all participate in it in some way, shape, or form, for sure. But it's kind of like our podcast aims to like take a step back from that outrage culture, still be mad about things and still get very heated about things, but at least give it a certain perspective that hopefully will educate people and so we can do better in the future.
I feel like the so obviously there in recent memory within the last year, there was the big controversy regarding sort of fantasy literature and, you know, what is or isn't problematic was J.K. Rowling. So J.K. Rowling, you know, is obviously one of the most popular authors in the world.
and she comes out basically speaking out against the rights of trans women to kind of self-identify as women and to be treated as women. And from my perspective, it's let's cancel J.K. Rowling for saying that. But there's people who are fanatically devoted to Harry Potter. And there's that one part of me that wants to say, well, if you like Harry Potter, you know, you might as well be eating a Chick-fil-A. That's how bad of a person you are. But there's another part of me.
Jesus. I love that comparison, though.
There's another part of me that's like, well, I've been playing Call of Cthulhu for a long time and reading H.P. Lovecraft for a long time, and he's far more racist than J.K. Rowling is transphobic.
Yeah.
He's much worse than anything that she's ever done. He's done much worse. But I still like his stories, and I recognize that there's a lot of terrible stuff in them with regards to racism. You know, I can't judge a person who still likes J.K. Rowling while at the same time liking H.P. Lovecraft.
Yeah, it's kind of that age old. And I actually talked about this on our podcast network that we're a part of. We have a bunch of other podcasts on there. We have a podcast called Right in the Feels, I think it was, that I guested on. And there was a whole episode where we talked about Harry Potter and the impact it had on our lives because, you know, I have a Harry Potter tattoo. Like, that's how much I love Harry Potter. And I have an encyclopedic knowledge of it. So when the stuff with J.K. Rowling came out, it was very like, oh, shit, I have a tattoo of this on my body. What the hell are people going to think of me? Which obviously was not a good way to think of it, because obviously I'm not the one that's being hurt or impacted. Like, I'm like, OK, got to take a step back. Like, hello. Like, it's fine. But we had a huge discussion about separating the art from the artist. And, you know, just because somebody is like a TERF or racist, you can hate them and you can have negative opinions on them, but the cultural impact that they had and like the way that their stories make people like entertain people or make people feel, it should be set. There should be a separation between that, because there's no denying how much books like Call of Cthulhu or games like Call of Cthulhu or any of H.P. Lovecraft stories or any of the Harry Potter books or even Orson Scott Card, who wrote Ender's Game, huge homophobe, disgusting homophobe, but like his books defined what modern science fiction is, you know, and they have big cultural impacts. And it's like that separation thing. It's such a difficult conversation to have. And like, I feel like there's not really one right answer, you know?
I think it's a dynamic process. It's not, well, we completely throw everything out or we completely accept everything. We, you know, you have to kind of take it on a case by case basis. Even with H.P. Lovecraft, some of his stories, you know, some of his stories are super racist and you can kind of just throw those out. And then there's some that, you know, they don't really have racist themes to them. You know, he was a racist, but not necessarily every one of his stories has those themes.
Yeah.
And then some, in some cases it's both. And it's, I think that the process of trying to reconcile those things makes you more aware of the imbalance between the two as it relates to just sort of modern society. I guess that's kind of a generic way of putting it, but it's an ongoing process. It's not a static process.
I think it's just important to be aware of the content that you are consuming. So being aware that like maybe this author was racist, so maybe there is like, I'm not going to say like all their stories are going to have hidden racism, but to be aware of like, you know, that everyone's perspectives and opinions are always go into their work, whether or not they want it or not. Like, you're never going to be able to write a completely unopinionated like piece of writing. But I think just being aware of that fact, and like, you consume what you want. Like, you want to read stuff by this author, sure, like go for it. But just as long as you're aware that, you know, take it with a grain of salt or something. But
I've encountered this problem a little bit more specifically to how it relates to what we're talking about. So my podcast obviously is focused mainly on Dungeons and Dragons novels. Most of what we'll be talking about today comes from the 80s with the Dragonlance novels. And it's hard to parse what is worth keeping, what is worth discarding, because they mean so much to me. You know, I do have a Cthulhu tattoo, but I don't have a Dragonlance tattoo. So it's hard. I mean, for me, I'm a bit too old to have grown up with Harry Potter exactly, but I did grow up with Dragonlance, and it's a fundamental part of who I am. I can't say, well, these are outdated attitudes towards women, so I'm just going to completely throw all this out and act as if it's all bad and just pretend it never happened. I can't do that.
And it's hard. It's such a fundamental part of who, like, these are formative years that we're talking about, right? And it's like, these are our childhood and adolescence, and it's hard to throw out. Like I say all the time, is like a joke, or like, honest to God, like, Harry Potter was my one personality trait like for a really long time. So it's like, when you, I'm literally not joking. If you ask people from my high school, like, what my defining characteristic is, it's not like, oh, she's the girl. It would either be, oh, she's the girl with the glasses, or, oh, you mean the Harry Potter girl. Like, that was my personality, just all of it. So, and that, you know, when you take away like something like when you take away like H.P. Lovecraft or J.K. Rowling, it's just like, oh, well, is my whole childhood and like what I grew up adoring, like, is that wrong? Am I wrong? And you go through this whole like existential thing, which, not to make it about us, because obviously it's a bigger picture and it's a bigger problem, but it's something, yeah, like we said earlier, like, it should be handled with care, and it's a process.
Right. And so, and with Dragonlance more specifically, Dragonlance is a bit different because it's not the sense, the authors are Margaret Weiss and Tracy Hickman, and it's not as if they are the problem. It's the issue is what Dungeons and Dragons culture was, what fantasy culture was, what 1980s culture was, and how all these social tropes and fantasy tropes and genre tropes, how they kind of infused their stories, in the sense that you can't write popular fiction without relying upon certain tropes. If you were writing some kind of experimental literature, you know, you could, you know, really break the mold. But, you know, they're writing adventure stories for a large, diverse audience, and they need to follow certain conventions. And if the conventions of their time and of their genre are this and that, are, you know, the things that we're going to be getting into later, if that's what people are writing in that time, they're kind of bound to those conventions. So unlike J.K. Rowling they're all different cases. You got H.P. Lovecraft, who's a racist, and there's racism in his books. You've got J.K. Rowling, who's a raging turf in real life, but I've read all the Harry Potter books. I don't see any, and I don't see any anti-trans stuff in them. And then you've got Margaret Weiss and Tracy Hickman, who I definitely give the benefit of the doubt in terms of their intentions, because their attitudes do evolve. It's a series that's been going on for almost 40 years now, and their attitudes do evolve, but at least at the beginning, they're very much bound by the conventions of their genre and by their time. So now that we've said all that, I just wanted to know, so I wanted to get a little bit of your perspectives for the people listening who haven't necessarily listened to your podcast, which everybody should. But I wanted to know, generally speaking, how has the game itself, the way the game is built, or the community around it, how would you say it's made women feel excluded in the past? And is it still a problem today?
Oh man, where do we start?
Just go listen to every episode of Slovenly Trolls.
Just listen to every episode. We have 4 episodes out. Just binge them. The conclusions that we've come to so far, because every episode we have, we always make a hypothesis or a theory as to why things are the way that they are. And I think the conclusion from all of our episodes so far is just one of them was Dungeons and Dragons was very clearly, very, very clearly made for prepubescent white boys. Just in the way that the art is, the way that it's written, the pronouns that they use, the lack of pronouns that they use, the way the things are described, it's just the writing on the wall. You look at the rhetoric, you look at the visual cues, you look at the male gaze, it's all there. And yeah. You even look at Gary Gygax, who is one of the founders of Dungeons and Dragons, if not the most prominent figure of the whole entire franchise. And he has gone on record before saying that, yeah, he didn't really consider women because he didn't think they were smart enough because he was a biological determinist. And he thought that women didn't have the wherewithal or the smarts to comprehend Dungeons and Dragons. So he didn't bother pandering to them.
And what about today? And what we can see that these sort of attitudes, this especially in the art and the way that women are portrayed in the game, how this might have, you know, maybe in the 80s and 90s kind of excluded, made a lot of women and girls feel like they were not welcome in this space. But what about today? Is it still a problem today? Is it resolved today? Is it a work in progress?
I mean, I would say it's a whole lot better today. I think Wizards of the Coast are doing a phenomenal job of trying to be inclusive, getting people and just like all kinds of people, not just like women or yeah, just not just catering to the kind of white male prepubescent boys, I guess, and trying to get, you know, trans and women and non-binary people. And I think they're doing a phenomenal job about that. And it clearly shows that they do know who their audience is, that it's more diverse than, you know, they've been looking at in the past.
Yeah. And you look at like the new Ravenloft book and they gender bend one of the characters from what I heard. And then like you look at how the art is, and while there are still problems with the art and how some women are portrayed, there's still boob plate, there's still very weird contortions of the female body, but compared to how the art used to be, it's still an improvement. It's not perfect, but it's still an improvement. And you can kind of, if you study Dungeons and Dragons through whatever lens you wish to, you can see a very clear pattern of them following they're a more diverse audience. And, you know, the cynic might argue that we're in a quote unquote woke culture now, and they're just following what's good for business, which could also be true because we are in a period of change right now where a lot of people, thank God, are finally getting the rights and the respect they deserve. And maybe it's a corporation just seeing, oh, we should probably cater to these people. But I also think, you know, there's a good way to go about it. And it's in the text, it's in the art, it's in the rhetoric that's hidden underneath the surface. And you can tell when, I think personally, you can tell when it's more surface level. And I don't think with Dungeons and Dragons, it's surface level, because you can just see from like every little detail of the books that they're releasing, all of the content that they're promoting, all of the people that they're giving a platform to, it just, every single area, it just seems like they are trying to improve. And it is a slow process because they have a lot of time to make up for and a lot of really bad reputation to mend. But
there's a lot of baggage that they have.
There's a lot of baggage that they got to overcome.
Well, Lissa, what kind of baggage? What kind of baggage?
Some of the wording, some of the, like, the bane of our existence is 2E, where they just use the he pronoun. They essentially, in the beginning, they have an introduction that says that the he pronoun is the most kind of gender neutral and only correct way to address both sexes, or all sexes, I guess. And then there's, you know, there's the harlot table, which we based kind of title of our a whole podcast on, you know, the strength cap table. These are things that, like, if you've been playing Dungeons and Dragons, you may or may not have heard about already. You know, how gender stereotypes were back then. You know, it's going to be in the game itself, just from, you know, how society was back then, even. Kind of like a snowball effect. It's in the game. And so what we do is we criticize and talk about all of these issues that they have, but as long as they're trying to improve, you know, I think that's the main point, which they have been trying to do.
And since you mentioned the word gender stereotypes, that's a good segue into our next discussion. So I want to talk about we're going to talk about the Dragonlance novels and how the attitudes towards women in those novels feel a bit dated to a modern reader. They feel a bit sexist, and we'll kind of try to parse what that means, you know, for somebody reading the books now, and how we can reconcile our appreciation of these books and our appreciation of these characters and of these authors, but still with a keen eye from a modern perspective. And I just want to preface by saying that, as I mentioned before, I'll just mention it again right off the top, that this is not, I'm not intending to criticize the authors, especially since one of the authors is female. These books are written by Margaret Weis and Tracy Hickman, and Margaret Weis is a woman. Tracy Hickman is a man, but Margaret Weis is a woman, so I'm just going to give her the double benefit of the doubt that she's not intentionally being sexist. But I think that the conventions of the genre and the conventions of the time really infuse these characters. So that's kind of what I want to explore. So we're going to go through a few characters who are much beloved characters, but they do have they each have kind of a moment that rings a little bit off key for a modern reader. The first one I want to talk about is a character named Tika Whalen. She starts out the novel she's about 19 years old. She's a human bartender living in a small town. She ends up leaving her home to go travel with these adventurers. And she falls in love with a warrior character named Caramon. And he essentially falls in love with her too, but there's a moment towards the end of the, maybe three quarters of the way through the first novel, where it's revealed that Caramon has supposedly heard these rumors that Tika is like the town slut and she gets with all the guys in town. And that creates a conflict for him because he feels like he's no longer romantically attracted to her because he feels that she's, you know, the town skank. Then later, he finds out from the character named Goldmoon that she's not really the town slut. That's just the rumor going around. And she's never been with a man. And if Caramon asked her, she would be with him, but Tika wants to wait. And that kind of earns Caramon's respect once he realizes that Tika is actually a good girl and she wants to wait until she's ready. Caramon gains new respect for her, and he's, well, if that's what she wants, that's fine. And so that's sort of their story arc. They wait, you know, they don't have sex then. They wait until they're married eventually. But that attitude, I mean, I guess it's a reflection of that time and that sort of double standard of, you know, it's okay for Caramon to go running around getting with all the women, but if Tika is going around getting with lots of men, then suddenly she's tainted. She's she's used goods at that point, and he's not interested.
Yeah, that's very much a trope of, like, not even literature, but just media. I remember I wrote a paper. My first ever women's gender studies class that I took, I wrote a paper on this because it was like my feminist awakening about, you know, how much of a double standard there is when it comes to men and women's sexuality. And I remember describing it as kind of like, you know, women and men wear their sexuality like scars on them. If you see a man with scars, he's seen as like manly and somebody to look up to, and he's been through some shit. But when you see a woman with scars, you think, oh no, that poor woman, like, that's not ladylike to have all those scars. You should probably cover those up, you yeah. know? And it's like this complete double standard that's just been prevalent throughout time. And does Caramon canonically, like, actually, like, have sex with a bunch of people? And then it's like, so it really is like that dichotomy of somebody who is like a slut versus a not slut.
Well, I mean, Dragonlance is very sort of PG-13.
Okay. So
whether he actively had sex with anybody else is...
But is it implied?
I would say it's very much implied.
Okay. Mm. Got it. Gross. Hate that dichotomy. You know, Caramon's cool with having sex, but when Tika yeah. is implied to have it, very reminiscent of the time. That doesn't surprise me at all, unfortunately.
And speaking of double standards, there's a character called Goldmoon, and she's the human princess of the Kwaishu tribe, and they are very much kind of an analog to Native Americans. And they're also the Dragonlance version of quote unquote barbarians, which itself is highly problematic, obviously. Goldmoon is like the chosen one who's destined to prove the existence that the ancient gods who've been forgotten about for hundreds of years, she's the one who essentially proves that they exist and finds and becomes the first cleric of the true gods that's existed for hundreds of years. And there is a part where she's talking about how her and her betrothed, who's named Riverwind, how their tribe believes in waiting until marriage to have sex. And so she's going to honor that tradition by waiting until they're married to have sex. And it's not necessarily treated as kind of a moral issue. It's more like this is their tribe's custom. It feels a little outdated to most people. But of course, there are some people living today who still very much abide by that rule.
Mm.
But again, that sex before marriage thing is another double standard within a culture, even within the United States, that believes in waiting until marriage. If the man has sex before marriage, maybe it's treated as sinful and he should feel bad about it. But that's about it. If the woman of a young woman has sex before marriage, she's now tainted. You know, she wears the scarlet letter, not the man.
Tainted goods.
Yeah.
So do you think that still holds true today?
Not as much today, I feel like. But I feel there are a lot of people, usually of an older generation, who probably still hold a lot of those ideals. And there are younger people who do, too. It really depends on the society you're brought up in, if you follow a religion that has those tenets in them. But I think if you look at media as a representation of the culture, which, you know, there's a whole, like, scholarly niche of the world that studies this. Like, if you look at media to kind of reflect how the majority of the world feels about something, there is, like, research to back that up. So if you look at how sex is portrayed in the media now, there are a lot more people who are open with their sexuality, people exploring their sexuality, women embracing their sexuality. And I think as a society, we're way more accepting as we were. There still are groups that are not, but I think as a society, we've kind of moved on from that. And I think you can even study literature now and probably see that trend as well, like in any sort of storytelling medium. But no, obviously, yeah. The Dragonlance books were written in the 80s, so.
Yeah, I think, there's lately, it's way more liberal in terms of what is considered, like, moral. It's something that's changed over time, both in media and in just the arts as well. Yeah, I think it's, like, something... Obviously, there are more kind of conservative groups that still uphold, you know, these morals that are more of to upkeep, you know, their traditions and stuff. But I think that the general direction, I would say people are more open to being liberal and being, like, sex positive, which, you know, it's more of a modern thing. So, you know, looking at it from, you know, like a modern perspective, then yeah, it seems, you know, a little bit different. But there are still people who live in that kind of, with those morals and stuff. So it's not wrong necessarily, but it is restricting.
I think it's interesting that we talk about, you know, Harry Potter as this, as a, we talk about Harry Potter as a cultural phenomenon for young people, but if there's anything to rival Harry Potter in the modern era, it's probably Twilight, which is very much,
oh God,
very much not sex positive.
No.
I think it's tricky because on the one hand, Twilight is saying, you know, you need to wait until marriage. But on the other hand, I think that it's probably a part of the appeal of reading Twilight that you're just waiting for them to finally, you know, to finally have sex. You're waiting four novels or three novels for them to finally have sex. And
it is like confirmed, like Twilight has a bunch of Mormon ideals in it, right? Because the author was Mormon and well, part of Tracy, the Mormon church until marriage.
Tracy Hickman is Mormon also.
It all connects. Oh. That makes so much sense.
It's tricky because it's not necessarily an issue of Tracy Hickman trying to impose his morals into the book.
No.
I think the morals that are reflected in the book are much more to do with society at the time than with him specifically.
Yeah, and I think that also comes with because they're two authors, right? Margaret Weiss and Tracy Hickman. So right. I think like that balances out. If it was just Tracy Hickman's book, I think it'd be a different story.
Is but because Scott
people
Card?
Had input on it.
Orson Scott Card is a big time Mormon too.
Of course he fucking is. Of course he fucking is.
So is Brandon Sanderson.
Yeah, I knew Brandon Sanderson. Yeah.
I didn't know that. That's interesting.
What is up with these fantasy authors and being Mormon?
I don't know.
And like sci-fi and stuff.
I guess that's just the one lends itself to the other, I guess. I wanted to, since we're on the topic of this sort of wait until marriage, I wanted to talk about a specific incident in the books where people don't wait until marriage. And that is a character called Silvara and a character called Gilthanas. And they meet in the second novel and they, you know, fall head over heels in love. She's an elf, he's an elf. They fall head over heels in love and then they end up having sex before marriage. And it's not treated as something immoral. It's, you know, they're both in love with each other. They're going to get married eventually. So they have sex and it's not really treated as if it's anything that's bad. But then it's revealed that Silvara is actually a dragon. She's a dragon pretending to be a human. So
what?
So I think it's funny that the one instance in which two characters have sex and it's not treated as something immoral, one of the characters is, well, neither of them is human, but one is way not human. So I thought that was kind of interesting that the rules are different for dragons, apparently.
So it's all for plot. That's what the sex is there for. Like when it's kind of between two people, you know, you have to wait for marriage, but then for plot reasons, let's make it interesting. Like they'll have sex and, you know, she'll turn out to be a dragon because that just makes sense.
I don't even know if it's, I mean, yeah, it could definitely be a plot thing, but I just think it's just very unabashedly, if this is one of the only instances in the entire book where people have premarital sex, it's very transparently like humans and human-like creatures. So elves are probably included in this. Like anybody who's humanoid, they all go to that standard, but then non-human creatures like dragons, they're not humans, so they can be sinners. It's fine. It's a dragon.
Is it almost trying to teach you that even if you do have sex before marriage, it's bad because this person's going to be turn out to be a dragon? So essentially, what teaching you that sex before marriage is bad because you're just going to end up fucking a dragon?
I want to be a dragon. Does that mean like if you have sex before marriage, you're a dragon? I want to be a dragon.
Well,
I don't
even
know what it's trying to teach you.
There's only one way to find out. Tune in next time for real.
For Sharday's personal firsthand account of how
And it's interesting. It's interesting the sort of aftermath of Gil'thanas and Silvara. I don't know if this necessarily relates, but he ultimately ends up rejecting her. They have a very sort of complicated relationship. He can't stop being in love with her, but he doesn't want to be married to a dragon. So he kind of resents her, but they're kind of stuck with each other. And it's an interesting kind of thing.
It is interesting.
I think it's supposed, it's supposed to be like a tragic romance. That's kind of what they're going for, that these two are in love with each other, but they can't be together because the one is a dragon and the other's a dick.
One is a dragon and the other's a dick.
Yeah, essentially.
Yeah, yeah, I wonder. I'm sure there's a metaphor in there somewhere.
I can get the feeling based on just the two instances of I think Tika and the person who liked her, of like they just want to create this conflict between the two, between like different opinions towards things, I guess.
I think the idea like, is maybe supposed to be that Tika is like Caramon's redemption. She pulls.
Oh, I hate that.
She pulls him away from his woman chasing ways.
So, like, she is reduced to a plot point. She's not a person. She is somebody else's, like, redemption.
In a sense, yes.
Yeah.
Not fun. I don't like that. That's very problematic, but it's also, again, it's not a one-off instance. Like, I feel like there's a book that I was writing, because I was doing a bit of background research on some of these characters, and a lot of them just reminded me, especially the love triangle I'm sure we'll talk about briefly at some point between Kitiara and Lorana, or Lorana and Tanis. It reminded me a lot of a love triangle in Brent Weeks's Night Angel trilogy, which is another fantasy series. I don't know if Brent Weeks is a Mormon. I'll have to look into that later.
I doubt it.
I mean, it's a great trilogy, but there's a love triangle between three characters, one of which is kind of seen as like a seductress woman who is in charge of her own personhood and sensibilities and what was evil, but then is then redeemed. And then there's another woman who is basically just a metaphor for purity. And the guy ends up with the metaphor for purity because he needs to be redeemed because he is a big time assassin.
Mm-hmm.
And he needs to be redeemed in order to end up with the pure person, not somebody who will, you know, further pull him away into the darkness.
That sounds very Kitiara and Lorana to me.
I think it had to have been influential because I think the Night Angel trilogy definitely came out after Dragonlance. So it would not surprise me at all if Brent Weeks was influenced by that love triangle, because it was just, it was so, I remember reading the book and liking the other character better. Like, I liked the woman who was more in charge of herself and her sexuality more than the purity insert, because it was not that the other character wasn't a good character. She still had a lot of redeeming qualities about her, but it was just so obvious this character was choosing between the light and the dark. And that choice reduced these two otherwise pretty good female characters into plot devices, which is not uncommon in fantasy at all. Even though, you know, you have dragons and all these otherworldly creatures you could use as metaphors and plot devices. No, just use the women. Just use the women. It's fine.
Oh, they're just objects. They're just part of, you know, the book. They're not real people. They're not even supposed to be real people. They're just there for, you know, could be any woman.
They're just there for the man's story. They're
exactly to further the man.
They're NPCs to the PCs.
They're NPCs to further the man's plot.
That's interesting. Exactly. It's funny because if you think about it, I know this was not true. There's a whole story about the creation of the Dragonlance adventure and how they had this group of men and women playing as the characters who ultimately become the characters in the books. But it's interesting to think of it that way, because if you imagine the players of early Dungeons & Dragons being men playing male characters, then you wind up with the female characters in the novels as being the NPCs from the game.
Yeah, if that is a true that they base Dragonlance off of an adventuring party, and like some of these women characters just don't feel like characters that women would play. They feel like NPCs. I completely agree. They feel like just male gaze versions, even of female heroes sometimes, which is unfortunate because like they're trying to do something good, but they're tainted by the male gaze of like what women are supposed to be and what women heroes are supposed to be.
And for sure these women are not, they're not just kind of, you know, fawning little kittens. They're, you know, mm-hmm. they're fighters, they're generals, they're leaders of the people, but they kind of keep falling back into that role of being the plot device for the man.
I mean, maybe the characters themselves, if they were ever played out, were actually like full blown out characters, but for the sake of the book, they were just, you know, they gave the Spark Notes version and
right. I mean, as
fit them into roles and fit them into plot points, because that's how it'll make this book better when the women are plot points.
And I think it's very much the case with Kitiara and Larana. We'll get to that later, but they're, you know, they're both really great characters, but ultimately they are foils for Tanis. They are static characters reflecting different aspects of this dynamic male character.
That's all for this episode. Please tune in next week for part 2 of my interview with the Slovenly Trolls, where we will take a deeper look at some of Dragonlance's most iconic female characters, from Dragon High Lord Kitiara Uthmatar to revered daughter Lady Crisania, and finally to the Queen of Darkness herself. Thanks for listening, and I look forward to talking with you again.